From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1992, when a man named James Norman came to Rochester. He had been hired to take over the leadership of Action for a Better Community. The organization's longtime leader, James McCullough, had died a few months earlier. McCullough had spent decades as an outspoken pillar of the community, and James Norman was coming in with a different style, it's fair to say. He recently told the Democrat and Chronicle, quote, "I've put an emphasis on a different type of advocacy than the 60s and 70s style. Just because you can print a sign and march around a building doesn't mean you're doing advocacy. It can be making sure you're in the right room in the right time. It can be using data to make your case. It can be organizing and collaborating," end quote. And now James Norman is retiring after his own 25-year run. As he leaves his post as president and CEO, we asked him to discuss a number of issues at the forefront of his work. Among them is anti-racism education, including the effort known as FREE, Facing Race, Embracing Equity, and a lot more. James Norman, welcome back to Connections and happy retirement in advance.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up, this is the last few days here.
Probably about 31 days, 32 days.
The 31st of January is
right.
Okay, you got a month left here.
Yeah,
okay, you're not packing boxes today, so I don't feel that bad.
Not yet.
And Randy Gorbin is here, the news director for WXXI, stopping in to say hello. Hi, Randy.
I am not retiring after 25 years.
But I didn't ask you.
I will say that a lot of people have been listening to WXXI, of course, for a long time, and we think we've hopefully been of service to the community, but want to do a lot of exciting things in the next year. And, of course, that all takes some money. Just to continue the kinds of resources that we use to bring you programs like Connections every day, great discussions. It's great for Mr. Norman to come in today. But if you want to be part of the conversation and enjoy it for a long time to come, help us continue what we need to continue this kind of programming by calling now at 263-9994. 263-9994. It's our one-day drive. We're just going to do this today, and then no drives until next year sometime. You can also go online at WXXINews.org. Whatever amount you can give, make it easy. Maybe become a sustaining member, $10 a month, $5 a month, more. Whatever you can do will help us continue the kind of programming that you are getting today. Really fascinating discussion last hour on the Erie Canal, and really looking forward to hearing Mr. Norman's insights on what is going on with a lot of the topics Evan was talking about, structural racism, poverty, so many important issues to be discussed in this community. So do it right now, 263-9994, or you can donate online at WXXINews.org.
Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
James, in 1992, 25 years ago, you take over this post. What do you think the biggest change in Rochester has been in 25 years?
Well, the biggest change in 25 years, perhaps the fact that the community for maybe close to 10 years has begun to deal with a very sensitive subject, and that is the subject of racial inequality. That's something that, again, it's not something that's naturally people gravitate to, some people run away from, but it is a fact of life, and it's something that we need to look at and deal with if we're going to progress in any number of areas within our community.
Can I ask you to kind of go a little further? If you're going to say no, but I'm going to ask you anyway, okay?
Okay.
You told the Democrat and Chronicle when you talked about the last 10 years about the anti-racism efforts in this community.
Yes.
That has been a place and a point of change.
Yes.
And here's what the Democrat and Chronicle wrote. They wrote, quote, "For example, he said the inclusion of a structural racism plank in the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative mission met with strong resistance from some of the most influential people in the community. Norman said, I was amazed at their unease, given where they sit. You would have thought we were trying to destroy Rochester. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination that everyone is going to get it, but I do know that some people who need to get it don't have it. They just have some words," end quote. It's my job to ask you who you were talking about.
Well, I still won't say, I don't think it's polite or proper to say who the people were, but there are people that we all know who are always in the news. When we had the discussion about the actual wording of the plank that's in the within the Anti-Poverty Initiative document, they seem to, one person seemed to take it as a personal attack, and certainly addressing structural racism isn't about attacking individual people. It's about attacking a system of practices and policies that systematically reward one group of people while denying opportunity to another group of people. But that was one reaction. The other reaction was that it didn't seem to, the plank itself didn't seem to recognize the good things or things that have happened in our country in the last 100 years that were designed to deal with that issue. And so those were a couple of the reactions that we were...
What were you thinking about when you're sitting in the room hearing this pushback about this?
Well, I was thinking in the one hand that we aren't trying to write, something that's supposed to be flowery and, talk about good things. We're talking about something that's very serious, very negative, that needs to be addressed. And so it wasn't about, that we passed the Civil Rights Act or that there was a Martin Luther King, et cetera. At the same time, I was thinking that we couldn't address this if we have to always think about the individual reactions that people have. And of course, I recognized or I appreciated, the intelligence and the degree to which these people have progressed themselves. And it was just surprising. I couldn't understand the concerns with some of the wording that we originally had proposed.
Maybe if it was 1992 or 1997, you'd be less surprised. But doesn't it feel like there's a lot more emphasis in conversation about these issues to have elected leaders? I'm assuming, by the way, we're talking about white leaders.
Yes, we are.
Okay, elected leaders.
Not necessarily.
Some.
I'm only talking about maybe three people per se.
One elected, two appointed, and two not elected. Leading other organizations.
Yeah,
okay.
I won't say.
But white leaders in today's day and age, after all this discussion,
yeah.
I know there's a lot, there's still plenty, and I'm not perfect at all, but there's plenty of white people who don't want to just grab onto what structural racism truly means.
Right.
But to be in a leadership position in this town with all of the discussion, is that why it surprised you? Because of all the efforts in the last 10 years that here we are putting together this anti-poverty initiative and white leadership is still saying, wait, really? Structural racism? Is that why it surprised you?
Well, it surprised me. I just thought that I thought certain people were more attuned to, what structural racism means and what it has done to our country and to our community, than the people I'm referring to. But at the same time, when you reflect on it, we were, you and I and a whole bunch of other folks were raised in a society that presents history in a certain way. A Europeanized version of history where the accomplishments and the contributions of people of color, not just African Americans, but Latinos and others, American natives, have been minimized. And so that's, the textbooks minimize it, the teaching minimizes it, the recognitions minimize it. And so unless you are personally invested in looking at another reality, if you just take what's coming through our education system, you might think that the contributions that these other groups made weren't made. And when someone says that there's a whole nother side of history, that's runs contrary to their thinking, their socialization, and so that gets us into this whole issue of unconscious bias. Even, person that considers themselves to be the most progressive, most knowledgeable, still have these reactions, which have to be characterized as unconscious bias.
Sure, and by the way, the reason I pressed for the names is not because I want to sort of air either dirty laundry or to spark division? Because I know, I understand the reason James Norman is saying you're not going to name names is because you want to be a bridge builder and you want to work with people and you don't want to make it about that. The reason I ask is because I want to be able to call these people myself and say, what is it about structural racism that is a barrier for you to understand its power and the problem that it creates in our community? Let's talk about this. I want to hold them accountable. So I understand your decision not to name names, but can I ask you, in those three people, have you seen any growth since those conversations?
Well, I haven't really had any interaction directly with those individuals since the time we were actually creating the plank that's been included in the Anti-Poverty Initiative platform.
Do you have reason to think that there's been growth?
I seriously doubt it because we left our meeting, I think, pretty much thinking the way we entered the meeting. And in the course of a multi-hour discussion, I did not really see any change. I think overriding is a concern that we just want to not make people too uncomfortable. You know, if you say certain things, it sort of, you know, puts up a barrier in communication between you and the other person. And our feeling, you know, Dr. McMichael and I are the ones that created that plank. Our feeling was that, you know, you got to tell it like it is, and that's the best way to begin to attack it.
Okay, little note to self. Call Dr. McMichael after this program. I suspect he's going to take your tack, and I understand why. But this is distressing to me, and here's another reason it's distressing, James. When we talk about the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, this is a big coordinated effort to try to reduce poverty in a community that has some of the highest levels of poverty, child poverty, extreme poverty, of any city of its size in the country, usually first or second in most of these categories. So this is a vitally important effort in our community. And if behind the scenes, the leadership doesn't even really agree on the planks or doesn't even recognize structural racism, I'm going to be doubtful that this is going to work. Are you doubtful?
Well, for me, the jury is still out. We are 2.5 years into a 15-year initiative, and we are just really getting to the point where some of the working groups, the policy group, the systems group, the employment work group, and so forth, the funding coordination work group, some of these work groups are really just beginning to hit their stride. And so I'm hopeful that, you know, as these groups work on their various areas, that will actually, you know, come up with some systems changes and some policy changes, as well as programmatic changes that will help us, you know, really get on the road toward reducing poverty by 50% in 15 years.
James Norman is my guest for the hour, the outgoing president and CEO of Action for a Better Community, retiring after 25 years. You want to make some more news. Who's your successor?
Well, that person has been named. But we have a unique situation where the Department of Health and Human Services has the final say, the final sign-off, and so we can't preempt their sign-off.
That hasn't happened yet?
That hasn't happened.
Okay.
We've submitted the paperwork to them about a week and a half ago, and we're hoping to hear yet this week or at the latest early next week.
No one's listening. Just tell me the name.
Well,
just write it down on a piece of paper. And
the person is local.
Person is local.
Person is local.
So when we read the name, we're going to know that person.
Yes, you will definitely know that name.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is important because, you know, listeners who are hearing this program today, maybe you are very familiar with Action for a Better Community. Maybe it's a name you hear once in a while in the news here and there. And I think what's interesting is with James Norman's tenure is, you know, you came here in 1992, and my understanding of this, and I'd love for you to elaborate,
sure,
is that one of the things that you wanted to do was identify what your organization was and was not. In other words, you know, you can't do Thanksgiving turkeys. And I know that got some pub at the time, but
yeah,
that was part of your decision to say, we cannot be everything for everyone. Is that fair?
That's fair, because I think that an organization like ABC created in direct response to the riots of 1964, felt that it had to respond to, you know, all of the unmet needs that might be raised by the community. And so coming in, you know, with a history in community action at the local level and having overseen the network in Michigan for 9 years before coming here, I had a broad perspective of what the mission of community action agencies is versus, you know, what it's not. And so our job as an organization is to try to engage people in life-changing relationships as opposed to doing things which create repeat service. And so when it came to the whole Thanksgiving Christmas basket deal, we had a group of people on staff that spent 3 or 4 months a year just working on that. And some of the customers were repeat customers. And looking at the community of Rochester with lots of emergency resources, it seemed that other people were better positioned to do that than ABC. Now, ABC, of course, covers Monroe and Ontario counties. And in Ontario County, we contract with Catholic Charities of the Finger Lakes, and we contract with Pathstone in Ontario. So in Ontario, the Catholic Charities, on our behalf, doing services in Ontario, they do emergency services because the emergency services network in that community isn't as developed as it is in the city. So we recognize the need that people have, and if it's already being met by some other organization, there's no reason for us to do it. Another area was I had a person who I didn't quite know what they did, and when I got into what they were doing, is they were actually doing the job of either the legal services or the ACLU or the NAACP, but we weren't funded to do what they were doing. What they were doing was good stuff. I mean, helping people to resolve workforce, employment issues. Somebody was having trouble on the job, they would come, this person would go and represent them. You know, needs to be done, but not by us because that wasn't what we were being funded to do.
All right, so now you get a sense for Action for a Better Community and what the organization is in 2017. And we got a couple of phone calls. Let me work through a couple of phone calls. Listeners, if you want to jump in with questions or comments as we talk about the work that James's organization have done for 25 years, what work is ahead for this organization, for our community, for initiatives like FREE, Facing Race, Embracing Equity, and dealing with structural racism, and more, you can call the program, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Lisa in Rochester, first with James Norman. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. I was interested in James Norman's perspective on the importance of providing low-income housing for people in the city and outside of the city towards reducing concentrations of poverty and dealing with structural racism.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks for that question. The ultimate the ultimate answer to breaking up concentrated poverty is housing choice. And we know that that's not really a reality throughout our community. I'm very happy that the city council recently, you know, passed an ordinance that prohibits discrimination based on source of income. We need to see the same type of legislation countywide and statewide. And looking at the data on renters versus owners over the last 15 years, I've noted an increasing proportion of people's income going for rent among renters, to the point that in 2015, it was 43% of the average renter's income goes, for housing, and you know that's well over the 30% level, which when you get past 30%, that's considered to be a burden on a family. So whereas we have, as a community, relatively affordable housing compared to many other communities, when it comes to renters, from 2000 to 2010 to 2015, we've seen those percentages creep up in terms of how much they have to spend for rent. So for that group of people, affordability is not something they feel. What they feel is a burden. So I think that's very important because, you know, our schools are organized around the geographies we live in. And unless people can go to different places and get housing, right now they're mostly consigned, you know, into the cities. That's why we have concentrated poverty in the city. There's 107,000, people thereabouts who are in poverty in our county. And close to about 60,000 of those live in the city. And a high proportion of those are African Americans and Latinos. And that's reflective of the legacy of housing discrimination.
So what is, as you get ready to leave your post, when you talk to people in power, in legislative power and other offices, What are sort of a short roadmap of one, two, three things that could be done to start to change the concentration of poverty?
Well, number one is to, make it illegal for discrimination to take place on the basis of your source of income. So that's number one. Number two is to ensure that as new complexes are being built and new housing is being developed, particularly, rental type housing, that you ensure that there's a proportion that's truly affordable for people. And so I think those are two things I can think of that would be helpful in that regard.
And on the first one, illegal for discrimination based on income.
Source of income.
Source of income.
Source of income, yes. So what it means is if somebody has fortunate enough to get Section 8, which is hard to get, it's a long waiting list, or if they're like on DSS or DHS, if they have a public subsidy as a means of helping them pay for their housing, sometimes that's not acceptable or by some landlords.
Who's most to blame for concentrated poverty in our community?
Well, I'd have to say, institutionally, the Federal Housing Administration, federal government, because as you, I'm sure you well know, that we had about a 30-year period in this country when we developed the suburbs and we, created the mortgage subsidy, through FHA, and from the late 30s until the early 60s, $120 billion was put into mortgage subsidies. Less than 2% benefited people of color. And so that set up the system of discriminatory housing practices and legacies of that we have today. Even a person, that would have gone to, say, World War II and they got the GI Bill, well, housing wasn't as available to them if they were a person of color as it was for a person who was white. People, used the GI Bill to go to school. And a lot of the schools that are integrated today to some degree were like totally segregated, back 40s, 50s, up until, in some cases, the 70s. And so that is the template, that created the situation we live with today.
What is the role, if you see one, for example, the suburbs? Because certainly when we talk about affordable housing, there is the idea that in certain suburbs, it's not going to be welcome.
Right.
You think that's true?
Well, I'm sure that's true. I used to be a long time ago on the Board of Housing Opportunities. And I remember what a celebration we had when Rural Opportunities, Housing Opportunities was able to get Scottsville to accept a housing development with affordable units. Breakthrough, big breakthrough. Those have been few and far between. So one way for people to be a part of the solution, you know, is to be willing to open up their communities to you know, housing that brings in different levels of income than maybe the dominant income in their community.
It starts at the top with political leadership?
That's very important for it to be done, because if the political leadership doesn't support it, it'll be hard to get it done.
Yeah. Andrew in Irondequoit next on the phone. Go ahead, Andrew.
Oh, hey. I was just wondering, Mr. Norman, if New York became a more business-friendly state, would you think that could help this with your anti-poverty initiative by, you know, like cutting spending so that they could maybe not raise taxes or maybe cutting taxes and cutting spending or something like that? What do you think along those lines?
Well, if it became more business-friendly, meaning that if that meant that we had more employers coming to our state and to our community, offering more jobs and offering those jobs on a non-discriminatory basis, then I would say that would be helpful. But at the same time, we have to, regardless to whether it's a business-friendly state or a non-business-friendly state, we still have ingrained throughout our medical system, our education system, our criminal justice system, we still have those policies or practices that tend to reward one group and to not reward another group. And so just making the state more business-friendly itself doesn't change how resources are distributed among groups unless there's a consciousness about the patterns of discrimination that are built into our environment. And some of them are not so obvious, but are there nevertheless.
But can you get out of poverty if you don't have a job?
I think that having a job is just as important as having education. So number one for me is education. Number two is job. When you have those things, then your probability of being in poverty is very low, because there's definitely a correlation between educational level and income. And, yeah, if you don't have a job, you don't have a way to make a living. So that's very important.
All right. In a moment, we'll take Sam in Rochester. And if you want to call the program as we continue our discussion with James Norman, who is retiring as president and CEO of Action for a Better Community after 25 years, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. It's our only break of the hour, and we're right back with him next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, U.S. life expectancy has declined. Not a sharp decline in the past year, but enough to get researchers' attention. So what's driving it? We'll take a look at social factors, economic factors, perhaps even local factors. In our second hour, so-called fake news. Is it our fault? Is it journalists' fault? Well, we'll discuss all of that and more, and we'll talk with you on Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Randy Gorbin is WXXI News Director, and we try to jump in as little as possible throughout the year. At the end of the year, sometimes we do a one-day end of the year, let's finish it strong kick, and here we are, Randy.
You know, especially, Evan, if you didn't get to give or didn't have time or whatever during the last week that we held the longer type of pledge that we have going on here, this is the day to do it. It's also some tax implications for folks, too. Tax deductions are always useful, but I think the reason a lot of folks really want to donate is because they love the programming they hear here every day. And again, listener support, a very big part of our annual budget. What you hear on Connections, fascinating discussion last hour on the Erie Canal, listening to James Norman with so much institutional knowledge about what's going on in this community. Again, you don't hear that in a whole lot of places or in the kind of context that we provided to you right here. So please be a part of what we do here every day. Whatever you can contribute, $10, $20, do it per month, by the week, whatever, 263-9994. It's 263-9994, or you can go online at WXXINews.org and make a safe, secure donation that way. and know that you're contributing to hopefully one of the better places that you can listen to and participate in, as we are this hour, conversations that are important to this community. Evan.
Thank you, Randy Gorbman. Let's get back to our phone calls. And this is Sam in Rochester next. I'm with James Norman. Go ahead, Sam.
Hey, Mr. Norman, this is Reverend King. But you didn't contact me and ask me if you could retire. So your retirement is revoked as of this moment.
I asked my wife, how about that?
Well, she has power over all of us then. But the gentleman asked a question about can you get out of poverty without a job. That's not what I want to talk about. No, you cannot get out of poverty without a job. But what I wanted to say was, being a veteran myself, you know, there's a certificate that comes along when you get a VA loan for a house. And most veterans don't know that when you buy your first house and you pay for your first house, you can use that certificate over again and buy another house. And you don't have to live in a house. You can keep buying houses as long as you pay for them first. And you can buy property to rent or whatever you want to do with it. As long as you pay for the first one or the second one or the however many you want to get with that information. Now, I wasn't told that information when I bought my first house, but then I had to do the research to find out that information. But I just want to say to you, congratulations on your retirement, even though I didn't give you permission to retire.
I appreciate that.
On your retirement, because you have worked long and hard in this community. And I still say I remember when I first met you, we was at the top of the plaza. We had breakfast up there.
Exactly.
And we came. Yes. And that's been a long year. They've tore it down since then. So.
Yeah, they have.
Yes, but it's good to hear. It's good to hear somebody is getting out of this thing, you know, unscathed, you know, and you're able to enjoy some of your life. So God bless you and your family, and enjoy your retirement. I've been enjoying mine now for about 40 years. So,
well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for the phone call. 844-295-TALK. As we continue our discussion with James Norman, and some of our listeners are asking for your thoughts on the current presidential administration. Maybe it's a good time to kind of pivot and talk just a little bit about how you see things perhaps changing, or at least what the current climate's like. What do you think?
Sure. Well, unexpected. it's distressing and dismayed by the lack of forward movement in regard to bringing the country together. It's obvious that part of the strategy for, I guess, political gain is to try to keep people divided. And I'm thinking that it's just a nightmare that will be, gone away in a few years. It's unbelievable that this is where we are. I mean, I grew up in Georgia, went to undergrad school in Georgia. I remember, the guy with the pickaxes and running against Ellis Honorable. I remember, the governor of Alabama, George, before he sort of went through a conversion, let me say. And that's just something that you want to assign to the dustbin of history. But one thing we know is that progress does not go along a straight line. It goes sort of on an upward incline, but there are peaks and valleys, and we're in a valley, I'm hoping that we'll not stay in the valley too long.
You grew up in what part of Georgia?
Augusta, Georgia.
Augusta, Georgia.
Yes.
We could sidetrack for probably an hour or two just on your childhood, but what do you remember about racial division in the South growing up?
Well, at the time I, grew up in Augusta, there was a very definitely, de jure and de facto segregation going hand in hand. The housing patterns were severely segregated from my elementary experience all the way through my senior high school experience. All of my teachers, all of my counselors, were African American. There were no white people around the schools, except the superintendent of schools, Roy E. Rollins, would come maybe once or twice a year, once in the fall, once in the spring. They would say, on the PA, Roy Rollins in the building. And so you would be on your best behavior for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And that was that. But that being said, I knew that we didn't have always the best facilities or the best textbooks. Some of the textbooks, of course, we got from the, quote, white schools. But what we had were good teachers, teachers who believed that you could achieve. They had achieved. And so they made sure that they, you know, pushed you to achieve as well. So it's a bittersweet sort of reflection going to from there to a university that had been segregated from 1833 until 1963 was like a flip side experience where you were maybe the only person of color in your class. In many classes, sometimes maybe you might have another person. And, you know, dealing with, you know, people who just didn't look at you the same as they looked at themselves. So that was like a just opposite of what I had experienced K to 12. The communities at that time, the African-American community, was seemingly somewhat self-sufficient. I mean, we had Hart's Cleaners around the corner. We had the supermarket, you know, down the street. There was B.L. Dent Furniture Company. There was Swint's Shoe Store. And so occasionally we went to, quote, downtown, where, you know, the white merchants owned the businesses. And, you know, you would get certain things from Woolworth's or from Belk Department Store or Rubens Men's Clothing Store. But that was on special occasions. A lot of our trade was done within our own community. And so one thing that's changed today with more mobility in society, so one of the negatives is a lot of those entrepreneurs no longer exist in those communities. And so there's a greater dependency on a greater community, broader community for what you need, and less dependency on your own community for that.
I want to ask one follow-up to that, and then we'll get back to your phone calls with James Norman. And I want to be very careful. I don't want to misrepresent what Mayor Lovely Warren said in any way. I'm going by my memory here from the recent mayoral campaign in which she was at a public forum, and they were talking about education and the segregation, or at least sort of the... I know segregation is a term that implies actual policy, but whatever term you want to use, the divisions in our own community that we have here. Mm-hmm. And the mayor was pushing back against the idea that, you know, that it should be the only focus or the main focus. And she invoked Brown v. Board of Education, and one of her opponents in the campaign said, you know, did she just come out against Brown v. Board? I didn't hear that. I heard the mayor invoking the actual language that the Supreme Court used in the decision, which was pretty racist language that the justices used in making the Brown v. Board decision, which because they essentially were saying, well, you know, black people need to be around white people to get good education, or, you know, as opposed to saying there should be equal opportunity. And what the mayor, I think, was saying was set segregation or race aside. We need to improve educational approach, outcome, for everybody, regardless of who they are, where they're from, their income, their racial background, and it's not just about race. That's what I heard. I heard a lot more nuance in the mayor's answer than some of her opponents gave her credit for, and I thought it was a very interesting part of the conversation. So you, having grown up in Augusta, Georgia, seeing segregation at a really extreme level, well, certainly here in our own school system, we still have it in a much stronger than many cities see in the country. How much does that concern you, and any thoughts on what we should do about that?
Well, because of... when I grew up, because of the housing patterns and the segregation of the housing patterns, in my community, on my block, you know, I had a prominent preacher, I had a nurse. There were role models right on my street, and on many streets were like that. And so one of the differences that we have here is that because of mobility afforded by economics, we don't have as many role models as we like to have in some of our communities. And so that, you know, affects how people see things and how they pattern their behavior. So that's one issue. But as far as economic concentration goes, studies I have seen suggest that if you take children from an impoverished environment and put them in a more resource-rich environment, that it doesn't affect the children who are from the resource-wealthy families, but it does help the children that come from the less well-off families, mm-hmm. Because there's more exposure to different opportunities. And so you can make an economic argument, and then on the racial side, are there also studies that show that there's a more natural type of interaction that occurs between people from a similar culture. But you know, that's not something that's going to like change overnight in terms of the city school district. It's something that is being addressed through a pilot program. There's a new program that was announced, I think it was publicly announced in November, maybe it was early December. It was called the Victorious Minds Academy, where they have these islands of classrooms through several city schools where there's an effort to implement the relationship model of Dr. Jordy Grew. So I think this is a very positive development, and I believe that it's going to be successful in increasing student engagement and increasing academic performance. And if that, you know, proves true, then you have something that you can expand throughout the district to bring about better results, because the results that we're getting now are totally, totally unacceptable.
Mike in Rochester on the phones is next. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Mr. Norman, I just had a question for you. In regard to, you know, structural racial issues, how do you define that? I mean, so if I want to help make a difference, and I believe there are significant structural racial, issues that need to be addressed, but I have a hard time getting my arms around it in terms of like how to really make a difference with it. You know, so how do you define that? What are the attributes?
So the way I define it, and the way that, you know, is defined by many groups, including the Aspen Institute, is structural racism is defined as a system of practices, policies, laws that are in effect that systematically give one group advantages and disadvantages another group. And so if we look at the Great Recession of 2007-2008, and you look at the data regarding the changes in the relative wealth of African Americans or Latinos versus whites, you will find that the most negative impact was upon people of color. And so how did that happen then? What happened then, part of it was when loans were being freely given as they were prior to that time, people who didn't sometimes meet the right underwriting criteria were allowed to get loans because these things were like bundled into securities and sold and sold and sold. And so the person that was like actually, you know, doing the selling, they didn't have any loss because the loss ended up being, you know, the loss to the government, which we all end up paying for. And so people just making money, and it didn't matter whether there were going to be negative consequences on those people later on or not. And so when these mortgages began to, go up in cost, then many times it exceeded people's incomes. Also, you had people who qualified for prime loans who were given subprime loans just because of who they were. And so that would be an example of a more or less a contemporary way that discriminatory practices played out. But as far as what should individuals do, I think it would be well, I would commend individuals or of any race, ethnicity, to engage in some reading about our history that's not, you know, written by the mainline textbook companies. Read Slavery by Another Name. That's a great book. Read Michelle's book about the mass incarceration, in the United States. Read John Baptiste's book about the half never known. So there's lots of books out here that have facts in them that undeniable as far as how we have structured and tried to continuously justify our system. I mean, if you look at mass incarceration and you look at the fact that probably 65 to 70% of people incarcerated are people of color, there's something wrong with that. There's something wrong with that. And the fact that we countenance it, we accept it as it is, then that means we accept all of the myths behind it in terms of the criminality of people. We're not looking at the heavy caseloads in legal representation, not looking at disparities in sentencing. So there are lots of ways we can figure out how to intervene if we do enough to study the problem.
And Mike, it sounds to me like what you're looking for is just not only a definition, but then maybe a kind of an action plan for highlighting it, or at least understanding what you might be able to do in a day-to-day life. Part of the problem with a structural anything is there isn't always an easy thing that the average person can do. One of the most important things we can start by doing, I think, is just reading and understanding. Taking what James just said, read, really be able to understand it, and then maybe try to see it in it play in our own lives. And then there will be times where sometimes it's a vote, sometimes it's financial support, sometimes it's a conversation over dinner. There are different things I think we can do once we understand it better.
Right.
But it's tough because it feels like, you know, well, what are we going to do? I mean, and it sounds to me like that's where your frustration comes from. It's like, well, what are we going to do about this?
Yeah, well, in the last year, you know, I'm in the advertising marketing, you know, realm. And in the last year, I run an organization called Peaceful Solutions. And, for a month, we got very involved with the anti-violence movement, downtown. And we had a billboard up that really, it promoted the fact that, you know, fatherhood begins in the womb. And I went downtown looking for photographers, graphic designers, who were African American, and I found some of the most brilliant photographers, designers, and other business men and women too, that got involved in helping with that effort. And I was really blown away by how creative these people were, how smart they were. And they helped make the campaign I was working on authentic, and they embraced it. And I was just wondering, you know, Mr. Norman, I can't help but think, as the black population is in decline, that there's a huge structural issue there. You know, I've met kids and interviewed kids that are between, let's say, 11 and 15, whom, know that they've had several possible siblings they were looking forward to have that were aborted. And when I look at, you know, the system we've created and whatnot, I'm wondering, is that part of the structural issue too?
All right, Mike, thanks for the phone call. We're starting to run out of time.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what you meant by the black population being in decline. I'm not sure what you meant by that. Anyway, I appreciate the fact that you know, you were open to actually you know, searching out a different talent for your work, and that you found that it was a positive experience. And so when it comes to linking back to another conversation, employers, if employers had that same attitude, and some do, but if more had that same attitude, that quote, these people can make good employees, then that would make a difference. And it's your mindset that makes a difference in a lot of cases, as whether or not people are given an opportunity or not given an opportunity.
Yeah, Mike was intentional about seeking out that work and was thrilled with the results. 20 seconds. Do you leave your post an optimist about the future of this community?
Yes, I do. I do, because I know that there is a growing sense of activism to make change, and we're at the point of no return in terms of people pushing for change, and eventually some of the changes we're trying to advocate for will happen.
James Norman, I hope you'll come back and stay involved in this community. You've been such a part of it for 25 years. Got about a month left, and he retires as president and CEO of Action for a Better Community. Thank you so much for taking the time for us this holiday season to share about your career, your thoughts on this. It's always great having you.
Great being here. Thank you.
That's James Norman. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Tiana Magnon, another day of doing great work with us. It's always great to have our colleague there behind the glass with us. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you Friday on member-supported public radio.